Yes, Your Honor. Are you ready?
Please proceed.
Yes, if it may please the court. Mr. Barra. In beginning this argument today, I wanted to pick which topic I wanted to address first, and I wanted to start with the second prong of the qualified immunity test. I want to start, and that is whether or not the constitutional rule was clearly established at the time of the offense back in 2012. There's two reasons I want to address that first. The first one is, I'm sure that the court is well aware, this is a matter of public import. In fact, as I was just scrolling through Facebook to start this argument, I ran across an article from The Atlantic published today on qualified immunity. The other reason I want to bring that up is because it's a constantly evolving area of law. There's been lots of litigation, and since we filed our briefs, there have been excessive force rulings in the qualified immunity area, both in this court and in the U.S. Supreme Court. I want to start with talking about a recent decision by the Eighth Circuit, McIntrush v. Pulaski City Sheriff, against the Pulaski City Sheriff. And it helps shed some light on Mr. McReynolds' case. As you know, Mr. McReynolds was taken down violently by two Independence, Missouri police officers, and it resulted in very serious injuries. Mr. McReynolds, at the time that he was taken down, was in fact compliant. He had gotten on his knees. He had put his hands in the air. He had responded to the officer's commands. He had asked for additional instruction from the officers when it wasn't clear, and the response was to slam him into the pavement so hard by both officers that it broke his jaw completely in half. But in McIntrush versus Pulaski City Sheriff, what this court said and what this court recognized, in fact, is that there's a very long history of case law in this circuit that says that body slams and similar techniques, when used against a nonviolent, non-resistant misdemeanant, is violative of the Constitution, and that prohibition has been clearly established.
Mr. Johnson, this is Chief Judge Smith. Which cases would you cite prior to the event here, which I believe was 2012?
Sure.
Which cases at that time and before would have put these officers on notice that the conduct they engaged in on that particular event and that in that particular event were violative of an arrestee's rights?
Sure. And this won't be an exhaustive list. I think that there's quite a few of them, so I may not cover them, but I would cite to Shannon v. Keller, Atkinson v. City of Mountain View, Bauer v. Norris, Feimster versus Dentyer, Dentjer, Montoya v. City of Flandreau. I would also look at Gaynor v. Rogers, Lambert versus the City of Dumas, Brown v. City of Golden Valley, and Carroll v. Storrs, Storz. I didn't supply the case citations in the argument. Many of these cases are cited in the brief. But we can find case after case where individuals in situations similar to Mr. McReynolds received a takedown, were injured, and it was held that violated an individual's constitutional rights. And again, I'm not confident that this is even an exhaustive list. There are, in the panoply of excessive force cases, we have weapons cases, things that look like wrongful death, but there are a lot of takedown cases, individuals who are taken down when they are arrested and result in injury, and this has been subject of litigation for a long period of time. So we can find a lot of cases dealing with that particular topic on the books. But the officers were aware, and certainly would have been aware, and the district court recognized at the time that they were aware that a hard takedown for somebody who's not resisting would in fact violate a clearly established right. You're not allowed to use that level of violence to cause catastrophic injuries to bring somebody into custody when they're not resisting. There's no physical force. They're not a threat. They're suspected of a non-injurious crime. And so the officers were well aware at the time that this was clearly established law.
Is it your position that there are no disputed facts that require trial in order to actually decide what occurred to determine if qualified immunity was applicable?
The facts as viewed in light to Mr. McReynolds would suggest that summary judgment was inappropriate and the case should have gone to trial. But yes, there are disputed facts. The principal facts that are in dispute is whether or not Mr. McReynolds complied timely to the officer's instructions and whether or not he responded quickly enough. There's also a disputed fact as to the location of his hands, whether the officers announced that they were police officers, and perhaps to some extent not discussed in the summary judgment order, the extent of the role that Officer Gentile played in the takedown. He was the one who wrote in his reports that he participated in the push versus
why would the identity of the officer matter when I believe there's information in the record that the plaintiff was aware at the time he went outside that officers were present?
I think that's disputed. I'm not confident from the 911 call that you could draw that factual conclusion. But let's assume that for the sake of argument that that's not in dispute, that his knowledge was that he was aware that they were police officers. His conduct was that he was compliant with them. He may have been slow to respond while he had processed what exactly was going on, but we can hear from the audio recording of the event that his conduct happened within a matter of seconds of them receiving the instruction, and certainly that can be inferred from that audio recording.
Mr. Johnson, you had, I think in describing the factors that were relevant on the clearly established prong mentioned, and I think your phrase was something like suspected of a nonviolent offense. Is that a fair characterization when the 911 call included at least an allegation that the dispute between the two people in the home was both verbal and physical?
If I said nonviolent, I may have misspoke. I said non-injurious, I think. But she was not. There was not an allegation coming in that there was an injury-related event. There was certainly an allegation of a disturbance, and we'll admit to that. But I believe that the 911 call came in that there were no reports of injuries and no reports of weapons.
So is that a distinction then between the type of offense and the allegations of what happened in the course of it that is relevant to the analysis? Is that your point?
It's only relevant, well, one, in the Graham versus Connor factors in analyzing an excessive force case, it lists the nature of the crime itself as one of the factors that the court considers, so we bring that up. But I think that the nature of that crime being a domestic assault call, that factor diminished and probably completely evaporated at the time that Mr. McReynolds complied with the officers. Once he stopped when they told him to stop, got on his knees when they told him to get down, put his hands in the air, the degree of threat that may have been present as a result of the initial information on the call being a domestic disturbance had almost completely evaporated. He was compliant and submitting to the officer's authority.
How far away from the house was he at that point?
Unfortunately, we should have submitted a map, but the sidewalk that we mentioned actually runs directly in front of the house, not away from the house. It runs to a driveway that is next to the house on the side of it. So he was in front of the house standing on the driveway between two cars that were parked front to back, tandem. So he was not some distance away. He was in front of it. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I was going to say, when you said not far away is some distance away, I'm still having a hard time trying to figure out, you know, how far away we're really talking about.
Imagine a suburban house with just a simple sidewalk coming out of the front door, wrapping around the house to a driveway on the side and then around to the back. He was at the end of that sidewalk next to the driveway. So mere feet from the house, 10 feet from the house, maybe 15.
Got it.
So, yes, I do. We're not alleging that it was initially an allegation of a nonviolent crime, but certainly non-injurious, Your Honor. The other thing is that when we look at this particular case, because of Mr. McReynolds' behavior, viewed in light, in a light most favorable to Mr. McReynolds, has him complying with the officers. He's not resisting. He's not fleeing. He's responding to their commands, and he puts himself in a posture that would let any objectively reasonable officer know that he was no longer a threat. He got on his knees and he put his hands in the air. That's what people do when they submit to authority figures.
In the briefing, Mr. Johnson, I just want to make sure you have a chance to address this. Opposing counsel makes a significant point of the statement of disputed and contested facts and the local rule in summary judgment. And how the district court handled it. Can you give us your characterization of how the district court handled it? It's in a footnote, sort of addressing the concern that maybe the rule wasn't expressly complied with, but seemed to move on from there. Can you give us your assessment of that or your understanding either from, well, both from this particular case, but if you can help us in how those kind of matters are normally handled in your district?
Sure. Really, it's not a subject that's a part of the court. It's not an issue on appeal. It's not subject to a cross appeal. It wasn't the basis of the court's ruling. So if the district court had said, that summary judgment is going to be granted in favor of the defendants because the plaintiff's response didn't meet a strict pleading requirement in a local rule, that would be the issue on appeal. But the court didn't do that. Okay, the court found, and certainly facts were listed and contested in the plaintiff's response, but the court didn't do that. The court's ruling was based on the facts as they were pled by the parties and as they were supported by the record. The ruling was a standard summary judgment ruling that was factual analysis vis-a-vis excessive force and qualified immunity analysis primarily. If it was something that the defendants believed that they were aggrieved by, they could have cross-appealed, but that didn't happen. It's not the basis of it. It was something that wasn't part of the court's order. So saying now that it should be the plaintiff's pleading should be disregarded because it didn't comply with...
We seem to have lost Mr. Johnson. Mr. Grisham or someone in St. Louis, do we still have Mr. Johnson on the call?
No, he's froze up with us as well. Mr. Johnson, if you can hear us, please disconnect and rejoin.
There he is. Unmute. You're muted. You're muted, Mr. Johnson. Okay, there you go.
Got it. My apology. It just shut down. I didn't touch it. Okay. Anyway, the local rule, Your Honor, I don't think it's not a source of relief for the defendants. The facts were construed in favor of Mr. McReynolds, and when the facts are construed in his favor, we can conclude that summary judgment should not have been granted.
Mr. Johnson, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I see. I'm at the 2-minute mark. I will reserve the remainder.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Barra?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to start with the statement by counsel regarding the cases that he believes put these on officers on notice of their conduct under Graham v. Connor, as well as the Kelsey decision that came out of the Eighth Circuit. I will agree that Mr. Johnson has come up with a number of cases in which he attempts to argue and analogize that this put the officers on notice. But I would remind this court what Judge Sachs noted in his order, and that was that the plaintiff had been unable to identify a case where an officer acting under similar circumstances was held to have violated the Fourth Amendment. And then Judge Sachs went on to identify and point out the Kelsey decision that came out of the Eighth Circuit that was handed down in 2019 and that was after the events of this case. And I think that's very significant in evaluating the officer's conduct with regards to Mr. Reynolds. The other thing that I want to point out, and I think Judge Kelly kind of noted this or pointed this out in one of her questions of Mr. Johnson, and that was what I would call the seriousness of the underlying crime. What these off...
The seriousness diminished at all because you're now one floor below where the incident took place. Presumably, the people are still up on the second floor. The child is no longer present. You're 15 feet away. He's intoxicated, of course. Does that diminish our concern about the nature of the offense at all?
Judge Erickson, I would take the position that, while I understand your question, the officers weren't aware of that at the time they were rolling to the site where Mr. McReynolds was. The officers were aware of a 911 call with regards to a domestic disturbance. And as they're rolling to that residence, they find out that that 911 incident, the domestic disturbance, has escalated. The female on the phone talks about how Mr. McReynolds is intoxicated and becoming very violent. And that's what the officers knew as they rolled up to that scene. And as Judge Sachs noted, from the time they rolled up on the scene to the time they encountered Mr. McReynolds was about 10 seconds. And I think that's very significant because we're off asking these officers to assess a situation in a small amount of time based upon what the 911 dispatcher has told them.
So, Mr. Barrett, if you take the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. McReynolds and you say that he had his hands up, he was getting down on the ground and was complying with all of the orders from the officers, does that still give an officer under the case law the opportunity to use the type of force that was here? In other words, there's nothing non-compliant about his actions. Can you rely entirely on the potential previously violent act inside the house to justify the force?
Judge, I think you have to do it in two steps. I think you have to evaluate the nature of the call and the violent conduct that was being communicated to them. And I also think you have to assess the potential danger that this subject posed with regards to a threat of absconding, a threat of not paying attention to the officers, and a threat of still being dangerous to the officers.
Mr. Barrett, to follow up on Judge Kelly's question, when even taking your client's view of what happened, that the plaintiff was only crouched versus on his knees, but that he did have his hands raised. Crouched means he has stopped. He is no longer moving away from the officers. His hands in the air indicate submission. And as I understand the dispute, it wasn't that he wasn't complying, but that he wasn't complying fast enough. That precipitated the force that was applied. What case supports police conduct applying this kind of force when there's compliance, there's not active resistance, but not quick enough compliance?
Judge, I'll be the first one to admit I can't find a case on all fours talking about quick or quicker compliance. However, my response to that would be, even though he was complying or responding, he still posed a threat to those officers. And it's the reasonableness of the officer, not the reasonableness of a person after the fact.
Reasonable is it, if you just look at the total time from the officer's perspective, you're looking at, it can't be more than 2 seconds that takes place, you know, and then there's this tackle with great force, you know, and we could talk about compliance, slow compliance, whatever, but we're supposed to look at the facts in a light most favorable to the non-moving party. And at that point, Mr. McReynolds, as we see it, is on his knees with his hands in the air. And someone says, get on your stomach, get on your stomach. He says, huh, or what? I can't remember exactly, but he makes some kind of an inquiry. And then he's tackled with great force. And it all happens in a second or two. You know, why is that reasonable?
Judge, I have to keep going back to the concern that the officer Schmidley had about this gentleman still being a flight concern and still being a threat concern. And we have to put it in the perspective of how the officer perceives it. And that was a concern he had, and that's why he did what he did. And I believe that it was reasonable under the circumstances, as Judge Sachs construed it to be. And I think that is the gravamen of the argument. That's about as best as I can tell you.
Can I follow up on that just a bit? What made the officers believe he was a flight? I think I understand your position about the danger because of the nature of the domestic call. But what about the information that the officers were given that made them believe he was a flight risk?
I'm not sure it's necessarily that the information that was given, but what they saw him do at the scene. When he starts coming down that sidewalk and that driveway, he starts to make a turn, starts to turn his body. And I think that's the significance of the flight risk that the officers were concerned of. I will
is that an undisputed fact then, that what you've just described, or is that a fact that your clients propose?
I believe it's an undisputed fact, but I see Mr. Johnson shaking his head in the bottom tier. And I believe it's an undisputed fact only because, based upon the record that we have right now, there's nothing that contradicts that. There's no evidence from Mr. McReynolds or any third party that contradicts that. If I may be allowed to just go one step further in the context of this excessive force claim, there are two excessive force claims, one against Officer Schmidley and one against Officer Gentile. And I think the claim against Officer Gentile, as Judge Sachs pointed out, fails under the qualified immunity, and also because he's not part and parcel of the overall conduct engaged in by Mr. or Officer Schmidley. And therefore, I think the decision to rule in Officer Gentile's favor and remove him from the case is very critical and important to Judge Sachs's decision, and that should be sustained.
Mr. Barrow, this is Judge Smith. Help me with the facts. As I understand it, Officer Schmidley was the first to approach the plaintiff, with Officer Gentile following. Is that correct?
Correct.
So when Officer Schmidley arrived, he was when he was the first to make contact with the plaintiff.
Correct.
And that first contact was a knee to the back and a strike to the head, or did the strike to the head take place when Officer Gentile arrived and provided the final push over, or did he make contact with the plaintiff at all?
We take the position that the only contact that Officer Gentile had with Mr. McReynolds was the handcuffing of Mr. McReynolds. He may have had his hand on his back at the time, but putting on the handcuffs is the only thing that Officer Gentile did. And there, I can't find anything in the record that contradicts.
Well, there is a statement that he made in his police report where he says that Officer Schmidley and I tackled McReynolds, right?
And I understand that, Judge. But I think that the evidence is to the contrary. I don't believe that Officer Gentile tackled the plaintiff. And I think, to the extent that Judge Sachs ruled in favor of Officer Gentile, he found that same base, that factual basis.
You know, but he can't find facts, right? Because we're supposed to assume all disputed facts in a light most favorable to the non-moving party.
I would agree with you. I'm not going to argue with you in that context. The last thing I would tell you in the context of the Monell claim is that we believe that, obviously, if there's no excessive force, there's no Monell claim. But I think more importantly is the ruling that Judge Sachs made with the Monell claim, because rather than conclude that there was no excessive force, he went one step further. And the step further that he made was that the plaintiff failed to identify any evidence to suggest that the city had a policy or custom which may have authorized the use of unconstitutional excessive force, or any evidence that the city failed to train its officers in the appropriate use of force during arrest. So I believe that this court can determine that there's no Monell claim against the city by reason that neither Officer Schmidly or Gentile engaged in excessive force, or for the reason found on page 14 of Judge Sachs's order. And I think that's clearly permissible for Judge Sachs to find a reason, a legally justified reason, for defeating the Monell claim. I don't have anything else. I wish I could conserve, set this aside for rebuttal, but I can't.
Well, just for clarification, since there is no cross appeal on the issue of the court's handling of the local rule, is there any issue before us with respect to the court going ahead and resolving the summary judgment without consideration of the local rule or without applying strictly the local rule?
Judge, I don't think the local rule argument applies, and I don't think it applies for this reason. I don't think that Judge Sachs adequately addressed that issue in the body of his order. But even if he had, he gave the plaintiff, Mr. McReynolds, the benefit of the doubt and viewed the facts in his favor. And I think from a practical standpoint, that resolves for the short term the issue of whether or not plaintiff's appellate brief complied with the local rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Johnson, your rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Barra started off talking a bit about Kelsey v. Ernst, in which was the principal case that the district court relied on. We certainly don't think that it's analogous. The plaintiff in Kelsey was noncompliant, had pulled away, disregarded commands. Additionally, the injuries that the plaintiff sustained there seemed to be somewhat different. It was a broken collarbone, but here, Mr. McReynolds has long-term lasting injuries as a result of the amount of force that was used. But I don't think, even if that is the most closely analogous case, I don't necessarily think that this court has to find a precise case on point. If we look at Taylor v. Riojas, which was a per curiam opinion that was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court on November 2nd, that was an instance where an inmate had been held in deplorably filthy conditions in a jail, and there were no cases on point that would have told the jailers that keeping somebody in a feces-laden cell for 6 days is unconstitutional. But the misconduct was so, so awful, so disgusting, that the court said, no, let's remember that, you know, the case law requiring the viewing of, for requiring us to look at prior precedent doesn't mean that we have to have something that is down to the molecule exactly the same in a prior case. That doesn't need to happen. In fact, based on Taylor v. Riojas, the court just recently sent back a case, I think it was out of the Ninth Circuit, just remanded a case because of because of the ruling in Taylor v. Riojas. I think that case was McCoy v. Alamu, and it was just remanded, I think, last week for the court to reconsider, the circuit court to reconsider in light of the ruling in Taylor v. Riojas. I see that I'm out of time. I'd like to talk more.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you also, Mr. Barra. The court wishes to thank both counsel for your briefing, the very professional argument you've provided to the court today to help us resolve the matter, and we'll take it under advisement.